After the feast was over, the father and mother mounted their throne-like seats at one side of the great hall, and Nomasir stood before them to give an account of himself as he had promised his father. It was evening. The room was hazy with smoke from the wicks of the oil lamps that but dimly lighted it. Slaves in white-woven jackets and tunics fanned the humid air rhythmically with long-stemmed palm leaves. A stately dignity colored the scene. The wife of Nomasir and his two young sons, with friends and other members of the family, sat upon rugs behind him, eager listeners. "My father," he began deferentially, "I bow before thy wisdom. 10 years ago, when I stood at the gates of manhood, thou bade me go forth and become a man among men, instead of remaining a vassal to thy fortune. Thou gave me liberally of thy gold. Thou gave me liberally of thy wisdom. Of the gold, alas, I must admit of a disastrous handling. It fled, indeed, from my inexperienced hands, even as a wild hare flees at the first opportunity from the youth who captures it." The father smiled indulgently. "Continue, my son, thy tale interests me in all its details." "I decided to go to Nineveh, as it was a growing city, believing that I might find there opportunities. I joined a caravan, and among its members made numerous friends. Two well-spoken men, who had a most beautiful white horse as fleet as the wind, were among these. As we journeyed, they told me in confidence that in Nineveh was a wealthy man who owned a horse so swift that it had never been beaten. Its owner believed that no horse living could run with greater speed. Therefore would he wager any sum, however large, that his horse could outspeed any horse in all Babylonia. Compared to their horse, so my friends said, it was but a lumbering ass that could be beaten with ease. They offered, as a great favor, to permit me to join them in a wager. I was quite carried away with the plan. Our horse was badly beaten, and I lost much of my gold." The father laughed. "Later, I discovered that this was a deceitful plan of these men, and they constantly journeyed with caravans seeking victims. You see, the man in Nineveh was their partner and shared with them the bets he won. This shrewd deceit taught me my first lesson in looking out for myself. I was soon to learn another, equally bitter. In the caravan was another young man with whom I became quite friendly. He was the son of wealthy parents and, like myself, journeying to Nineveh to find a suitable location. Not long after our arrival, he told me that a merchant had died and his shop, with its rich merchandise and patronage, could be secured at a paltry price, saying that we would be equal partners, but first he must return to Babylon to secure his gold. He prevailed upon me to purchase the stock with my gold, agreeing that his would be used later to carry on our venture. He long delayed the trip to Babylon, proving in the meantime to be an unwise buyer and a foolish spender. I finally put him out, but not before the business had deteriorated to where we had only unsaleable goods and no gold to buy other goods. I sacrificed what was left to an Israelite for a pitiful sum. Soon there followed, I tell you, my father, bitter days. I sought employment and found it not, for I was without trade or training that would enable me to earn. I sold my horses. I sold my slave. I sold my extra robes that I might have food and a place to sleep, but each day grim want crouched closer. But in those bitter days I remembered thy confidence in me, my father. Thou hadst sent me forth to become a man, and this I was determined to accomplish." The mother buried her face and wept softly. "At this time I bethought me of the table thou had given to me, upon which thou had carved the 5 laws of gold. Thereupon I read most carefully thy words of wisdom, and realized that had I but sought wisdom first, my gold would not have been lost to me. I learned by heart each law, and determined that, when once more the goddess of good fortune smiled upon me, I would be guided by the wisdom of age, and not by the inexperience of youth. For the benefit of you who are seated here this night, I will read the wisdom of my father as engraved upon the clay tablet which he gave to me 10 years ago. The 5 laws of gold. 1. Gold cometh gladly and in increasing quantity, to any man who will put by not less than one-tenth of his earnings to create an estate for his future and that of his family. 2. Gold laboreth diligently and contentedly for the wise owner who finds for it profitable employment, multiplying even as the flocks of the field. 3. Gold clingeth to the protection of the cautious owner who invests it under the advice of men wise in its handling. 4. Gold slippeth away from the man who invests it in businesses or purposes with which he is not familiar or which are not approved by those skilled in its keep. 5. Gold flees the man who would force it to impossible earnings or who followeth the alluring advice of tricksters and schemers or who trusts it to his own inexperience and romantic desires in investment. These are the 5 laws of gold as written by my father. I do proclaim them as of greater value than gold itself, as I will show by the continuance of my tale. He again faced his father. I have told thee of the depth of poverty and despair to which my inexperience brought me. However, there is no chain of disasters that will not come to an end. Mine came when I secured employment managing a crew of slaves working upon the new outer wall of the city. Profiting from my knowledge of the first law of gold, I saved a copper from my first earnings, adding to it at every opportunity until I had a piece of silver. It was a slow procedure, for one must live. I did spend grudgingly, I admit, because I was determined to earn back before the 10 years were over as much gold as you, my father, had given to me. One day the slave master, with whom I had become quite friendly, said to me, "Thou art a thrifty youth who spends not wantonly what he earns. Hast thou gold put by that is not earning?" "Yes," I replied. "It is my greatest desire to accumulate gold to replace that which my father gave to me and which I have lost." "'Tis a worthy ambition, I will grant. And do you know that the gold which you have saved can work for you and earn much more gold?" "Alas, my experience has been bitter, for my father's gold has fled from me, and I am in much fear lest my own do the same." "If thou hast confidence in me, I will give thee a lesson in the profitable handling of gold," he replied. "Within a year the outer wall will be complete and ready for the great gates of bronze that will be built at each entrance to protect the city from the king's enemies. In all Nineveh there is not enough metal to make these gates, and the king has not thought to provide it. Here is my plan. A group of us will pool our gold and send a caravan to the mines of copper and tin, which are distant, and bring to Nineveh the metal for the gates. When the king says, 'Make the great gates,' we alone can supply the metal, and a rich price he will pay. If the king will not buy from us, we will yet have the metal which can be sold for a fair price." In his offer I recognized an opportunity to abide by the third law and invest my savings under the guidance of wise men. Nor was I disappointed. Our pool was a success, and my small store of gold was greatly increased by the transaction. In due time I was accepted as a member of this same group in other ventures. They were men wise in the profitable handling of gold. They talked over each plan presented with great care before entering upon it. They would take no chance in losing their principal or tying it up in unprofitable investments from which their gold could not be recovered. Such foolish things as the horse race and the partnership into which I had entered with my inexperience would have had scant consideration with them. They would have immediately pointed out their weaknesses. Through my association with these men, I learned to safely invest gold to bring profitable returns. As the years went on, my treasure increased more and more rapidly. I not only made back as much as I lost, but much more. Through my misfortunes, my trials, and my success, I have tested time and again the wisdom of the 5 laws of gold, my father, and have proven them true in every test. To him who is without knowledge of the 5 laws, gold comes not often and goeth away quickly. But to him who abide by the 5 laws, gold comes and works as his dutiful slave. Nomasir ceased speaking and motioned to a slave in the back of the room. The slave brought forward, one at a time, 3 heavy leather bags. One of these Nomasir took and placed upon the floor before his father, addressing him again. "Thou didst give to me a bag of gold, Babylon gold. Behold, in its place I do return to thee a bag of Nineveh gold of equal weight, an equal exchange, as all will agree. Thou didst give to me a clay tablet inscribed with wisdom. Behold, in its stead I do return two bags of gold. So saying, he took from the slave the other two bags, and likewise placed them upon the floor before his father. This I do to prove to thee, my father, of how much greater value I consider thy wisdom than thy gold. Yet who can measure in bags of gold the value of wisdom? Without wisdom, gold is quickly lost by those who have it. But with wisdom, gold can be secured by those who have it not, as these three bags of gold do prove. It does indeed give to me the deepest satisfaction, my father, to stand before thee and say that, because of thy wisdom, I have been able to become rich and respected before men. The father placed his hand fondly upon the head of Nomasir. Thou hast learned well thy lessons, and I am indeed fortunate to have a son to whom I may entrust my wealth. Kalabab ceased his tale and looked critically at his listeners. What means this to thee, this tale of Nomasir? He continued. Who amongst thee can go to thy father or to the father of thy wife and give an account of wise handling of his earnings? What would these venerable men think were you to say, I have traveled much and learned much and labored much and earned much, yet alas, of gold I have little. Some I spent wisely, some I spent foolishly, and much I lost in unwise ways. Dost still think it but an inconsistency of fate that some men have much gold and others have naught? Then you err. Men have much gold when they know the five laws of gold and abide thereby. Because I learned these five laws in my youth and abided by them, I have become a wealthy merchant. Not by some strange magic did I accumulate my wealth. Wealth that comes quickly goeth the same way. Wealth that stayeth to give enjoyment and satisfaction to its owner comes gradually, because it is a child born of knowledge and persistent purpose. To earn wealth is but a slight burden upon the thoughtful man. Bearing the burden consistently from year to year accomplishes the final purpose. The five laws of gold offer to thee a rich reward for their observance. Each of these five laws is rich with meaning, and lest thou overlook this in the briefness of my tale, I will now repeat them. I do know them each by heart, because in my youth I could see their value and would not be content until I knew them word for word. The first law of gold. Gold cometh gladly and in increasing quantity to any man who will put by not less than one-tenth of his earnings to create an estate for his future and that of his family. Any man who will put by one-tenth of his earnings consistently and invest it wisely will surely create a valuable estate that will provide an income for him in the future and further guarantee safety for his family in case the gods call him to the world of darkness. This law always saith that gold cometh gladly to such a man. I can truly certify this in my own life. The more gold I accumulate, the more readily it comes to me and in increased quantities. The gold which I save earns more, even as yours will, and its earnings earn more, and this is the working out of the first law. The second law of gold. Gold laboreth diligently and contentedly for the wise owner who finds for it profitable employment, multiplying even as the flocks of the field. Gold indeed is a willing worker. It is ever eager to multiply when opportunity presents itself. To every man who hath a store of gold set by, opportunity comes for its most profitable use. As the years pass, it multiplies itself in surprising fashion. The third law of gold. Gold clingeth to the protection of the cautious owner who invests it under the advice of men wise in its handling. Gold indeed clingeth to the cautious owner, even as it flees the careless owner. The man who seeks the advice of men wise in handling gold soon learneth not to jeopardize his treasure, but to preserve in safety and to enjoy in contentment its consistent increase. The fourth law of gold. Gold slippeth away from the man who invests it in businesses or purposes with which he is not familiar or which are not approved by those skilled in its keep. To the man who hath gold yet is not skilled in its handling, many uses for it appear most profitable. Too often these are fraught with danger of loss, and if properly analyzed by wise men, show small possibility of profit. Therefore, the inexperienced owner of gold who trusts to his own judgment and invests it in business or purposes with which he is not familiar, too often finds his judgment imperfect and pays with his treasure for his inexperience. Wise indeed is he who investeth his treasures under the advice of men skilled in the ways of gold. The fifth law of gold. Gold flees the man who would force it to impossible earnings, or who followeth the alluring advice of tricksters and schemers, or who trusts it to his own inexperience and romantic desires in investment. Fanciful propositions that thrill like adventure tales always come to the new owner of gold. These appear to endow his treasure with magic powers that will enable it to make impossible earnings. Yet heed ye the wise men, for verily they know the risks that lurk behind every plan to make great wealth suddenly. Forget not the rich men of Nineveh who would take no chance of losing their principal or tying it up in unprofitable investments. This ends my tale of the five laws of gold. In telling it to thee, I have told the secrets of my own success. Yet they are not secrets, but truths, which every man must first learn and then follow who wishes to step out of the multitude that, like your wild dogs, must worry each day for food to eat. Tomorrow we enter Babylon. Look, see the fire that burns eternal above the temple of Bel. We are already in sight of the golden city. Tomorrow each of thee shall have gold, the gold thou hast so well earned by thy faithful services. 10 years from this night, what can you tell about this gold? If there be men among you who, like Nomasir, will use a portion of their gold to start for themselves an estate, and be thenceforth wisely guided by the wisdom of Arkad, 10 years from now, 'tis a safe wager, like the son of Arkad, they will be rich and respected among men. Our wise acts accompany us through life to please us and to help us. Just as surely our unwise acts follow us to plague and torment us. Alas, they cannot be forgotten. In the front rank of the torments that do follow us are the memories of the things we should have done, of the opportunities which came to us and we took not. Rich are the treasures of Babylon, so rich no man can count their value in pieces of gold. Each year they grow richer and more valuable. Like the treasures of every land, they are a reward, a rich reward, awaiting those men of purpose who determine to secure their just share. In the strength of thine own desires is a magic power. Guide this power with thy knowledge of the five laws of gold, and thou shalt share the treasures of Babylon. The Gold Lender of Babylon. 50 pieces of gold. Never before had Rodon, the spear-maker of old Babylon, carried so much gold in his leather wallet. Happily, down the king's highway from the palace of his most liberal majesty he strode. Cheerfully the gold clinked as the wallet at his belt swayed with each step. The sweetest music he had ever heard. 50 pieces of gold, all his. He could hardly realize his good fortune. What power in those clinking discs! They could purchase anything he wanted, a grand house, land, cattle, camels, horses, chariots, whatever he might desire. What use should he make of it? This evening, as he turned into a side street towards the home of his sister, he could think of nothing he would rather possess than those same glittering heavy pieces of gold, his to keep. It was upon an evening some days later that a perplexed Rodon entered the shop of Mathon, the lender of gold and dealer in jewels and rare fabrics. Glancing neither to the right nor the left at the colorful articles artfully displayed, he passed through to the living quarters at the rear. Here he found the genteel Mathon lounging upon a rug, partaking of a meal served by a black slave. "I would counsel with thee, for I know not what to do." Rodon stood solidly, feet apart, hairy breast exposed by the gaping front of his leather jacket. Mathon's narrow, sallow face smiled a friendly greeting. "What indiscretions hast thou done that thou shouldst seek the lender of gold? Hast been unlucky at the gaming table, or hath some plump dame entangled thee? For many years I have known thee, yet never hast thou sought me to aid thee in thy troubles. No, no, not such as that. I seek no gold. Instead I crave thy wise advice. Hear, hear, what this man doth say. No one comes to the lender of gold for advice. My ears must play me false. They listen true. Can this be so? Rodan, the spearmaker, doth display more cunning than all the rest. For he comes to Mathon not for gold, but for advice. Many men come to me for gold to pay for their follies, but as for advice they want it not. Yet who is more able to advise than the lender of gold to whom many men come in trouble? Thou shalt eat with me, Rodan, he continued. Thou shalt be my guest for the evening. And all, he commanded the black slave. Draw up a rag for my friend Rodan, the spearmaker, who comes for advice. He shall be mine honored guest. Bring to him much food, and get for him my largest cup. Choose well of the best wine, that he may have satisfaction in the drinking. Now, tell me what troubles thee.
It is the king's gift.
The king's gift? The king did make thee a gift, and it gives thee trouble? What manner of gift?
Because he was so much pleased with the design I did submit to him for a new point on the spears of the royal guard, he did present me with 50 pieces of gold, and now I am much perplexed. I am beseeched each hour the sun doth travel across the sky by those who would share it with me.
That is natural. More men want gold than have it, and would wish one who comes by it easily to divide. But can you not say no? Is thy will not as strong as thy fist?
To many I can say no, yet sometimes it would be easier to say yes. Can one refuse to share with one's sister to whom one is deeply devoted?
Surely thy own sister would not wish to deprive thee of enjoying thy reward.
But it is for the sake of Ahriman, her husband, whom she wishes to see a rich merchant. She does feel that he has never had a chance, and she beseeches me to loan to him this gold that he may become a prosperous merchant and repay me from his profits.
My friend, resumed Mathon, 'tis a worthy subject thou bringest to discuss. Gold bringeth unto its possessor responsibility and a changed position with his fellow men. It bringeth fear lest he lose it or it be tricked away from him. It bringeth a feeling of power and ability to do good. Likewise it bringeth opportunities whereby his very good intentions may bring him into difficulties. Didst ever hear of the farmer of Nineveh who could understand the language of animals? I wot not, for 'tis not the kind of tale men like to tell over the bronze caster's forge. I will tell it to thee, for thou shouldst know that to borrowing and lending there is more than the passing of gold from the hands of one to the hands of another. This farmer, who could understand what the animals said to each other, did linger in the farmyard each evening just to listen to their words. One evening he did hear the ox bemoaning to the ass the hardness of his lot.
I do labor pulling the plow from morning until night. No matter how hot the day, or how tired my legs, or how the bow doth chafe my neck, still must I work. But you are a creature of leisure. You are wrapped with a colorful blanket, and do nothing more than carry our master about where he wishes to go. When he goes nowhere, you do rest and eat the green grass all the day.
Now the ass, in spite of his vicious heels, was a goodly fellow and sympathized with the ox. My good friend, he replied, you do work very hard, and I would help ease your lot. Therefore will I tell you how you may have a day of rest. In the morning when the slave comes to fetch you to the plow, lie upon the ground and bellow much that he may say you are sick and cannot work. So the ox took the advice of the ass, and the next morning the slave returned to the farmer and told him the ox was sick and could not pull the plow. Then, said the farmer, hitch the ass to the plow, for the plowing must go on. All that day the ass, who had only intended to help his friend, found himself compelled to do the ox's task. When night came and he was released from the plow, his heart was bitter and his legs were weary, and his neck was sore where the bow had chafed it. The farmer lingered in the barnyard to listen. The ox began first.
You are my good friend.
Because of your wise advice I have enjoyed a day of rest.
And I, retorted the ass, am like many another simple-hearted one who starts to help a friend and ends up by doing his task for him. Hereafter you draw your own plough, for I did hear the master tell the slave to send for the butcher were you sick again. I wish he would, for you are a lazy fellow. Thereafter they spoke to each other no more. This ended their friendship. Canst thou tell the moral to this tale, Rodan?
'Tis a good tale, responded Rodan, but I see not the moral.
I thought not that you would, but it is there, and simple too. Just this. If you desire to help thy friend, do so in a way that will not bring thy friend's burdens upon thyself.
I had not thought of that. It is a wise moral. I wish not to assume the burdens of my sister's husband. But tell me, you lend to many, do not the borrowers repay?
Mathon smiled the smile of one whose soul is rich with much experience. Could a loan be well made if the borrower cannot repay? Must not the lender be wise and judge carefully whether his gold can perform a useful purpose to the borrower and return to him once more? Or whether it will be wasted by one unable to use it wisely and leave him without his treasure, and leave the borrower with a debt he cannot repay. I will show to thee the tokens in my token chest, and let them tell thee some of their stories. Into the room he brought a chest as long as his arm, covered with red pigskin, and ornamented with bronze designs. He placed it upon the floor and squatted before it, both hands upon the lid. From each person to whom I lend, I do exact a token for my token chest, to remain there until the loan is repaid. When they repay, I give back, but if they never repay, it will always remind me of one who was not faithful to my confidence. The safest loans, my token box tells me, are to those whose possessions are of more value than the one they desire. They own lands, or jewels, or camels, or other things, which could be sold to repay the loan. Some of the tokens given to me are jewels of more value than the loan. Others are promises that if the loan be not repaid as agreed, they will deliver to me certain property settlement. On loans like those, I am assured that my gold will be returned with the rental thereon, for the loan is based on property. In another class are those who have the capacity to earn. They are such as you, who labor or serve and are paid. They have income, and if they are honest and suffer no misfortune, I know that they also can repay the gold I loan them and the rental to which I am entitled. Such loans are based on human effort. Others are those who have neither property nor assured earning capacity. Life is hard, and there will always be some who cannot adjust themselves to it. Alas, for the loans I make them, even though they be no larger than a pence, my token box may censure me in the years to come, unless they be guaranteed by good friends of the borrower who know him honorable. Mathon released the clasp and opened the lid. Rodan leaned forward eagerly. At the top of the chest a bronze neckpiece lay upon a scarlet cloth. Mathon picked up the piece and patted it affectionately. This shall always remain in my token chest, because the owner has passed on into the great darkness. I treasure it, his token, and I treasure his memory, for he was my good friend. We traded together with much success, until out of the east he brought a woman to wed, beautiful, but not like our women, a dazzling creature. He spent his gold lavishly to gratify her desires. He came to me in distress when his gold was gone. I counseled with him. I told him I would help him to once more master his own affairs. He swore by the sign of the great bull that he would, but it was not to be. In a quarrel she thrust a knife into the heart he dared her to pierce.
And she? Questioned Rodan.
Yes, of course, this was hers. He picked up the scarlet cloth. In bitter remorse she threw herself into the Euphrates. These two loans will never be repaid. The chest tells you, Rodan, that humans in the throes of great emotions are not safe risks for the gold lender. Here, now this is different. He reached for a ring carved of ox bone. This belongs to a farmer. I buy the rugs of his women. The locusts came, and they had not food.
I helped him, and when the new crop came, he repaid me. Later he came again and told of strange goats in a distant land as described by a traveler. They had long hair so fine and soft it would weave into rugs more beautiful than any ever seen in Babylon. He wanted a herd, but he had no money. So I did lend him gold to make the journey and bring back goats. Now his herd has begun, and next year I shall surprise the lords of Babylon with the most expensive rugs it has been their good fortune to buy. Soon I must return his ring. He doth insist on repaying promptly.
Some borrowers do that? Queried Rodan.
If they borrow for purposes that bring money back to them, I find it so. But if they borrow because of their indiscretions, I warn thee to be cautious if thou wouldst ever have thy gold back in hand again.
Tell me about this, requested Rodan, picking up a heavy gold bracelet inset with jewels in rare designs.
The women do appeal to my good friend, bantered Mathon.
I am still much younger than you, retorted Rodan.
I grant that, but this time thou doth suspicion romance where it is not. The owner of this is fat and wrinkled, and doth talk so much and say so little she drives me mad. Once they had much money and were good customers, but ill times came upon them. She has a son of whom she would make a merchant, so she came to me and borrowed gold that he might become a partner of a caravan owner, who travels with his camels bartering in one city what he buys in another. This man proved a rascal, for he left the poor boy in a distant city without money and without friends, pulling out early while the youth slept. Perhaps when this youth has grown to manhood he will repay. Until then I get no rental for the loan, only much talk. But I do admit the jewels are worthy of the loan.
Did this lady ask thy advice as to the wisdom of the loan?
Quite otherwise. She had pictured to herself this son of hers as a wealthy and powerful man of Babylon. To suggest the contrary was to infuriate her. A fair rebuke I had. I knew the risk for this inexperienced boy, but as she offered security, I could not refuse her. This, continued Mathon, waving a bit of pack rope tied into a knot, belongs to Nabatur, the camel trader. When he would buy a herd larger than his funds, he brings to me this knot, and I lend to him according to his needs. He is a wise trader. I have confidence in his good judgment, and can lend him freely. Many other merchants of Babylon have my confidence because of their honorable behavior. Their tokens come and go frequently in my token box. Good merchants are an asset to our city, and it profits me to aid them to keep trade moving that Babylon be prosperous. Mathon picked out a beetle carved in turquoise and tossed it contemptuously on the floor. A bug from Egypt. The lad who owns this does not care whether I ever receive back my gold. When I reproach him, he replies, "How can I repay when ill fate pursues me? You have plenty more." What can I do? The token is his father's, a worthy man of small means who did pledge his land and herd to back his son's enterprises. The youth found success at first and then was overzealous to gain great wealth. His knowledge was immature. His enterprises collapsed. Youth is ambitious. Youth would take shortcuts to wealth and the desirable things for which it stands. To secure wealth quickly, youth often borrows unwisely. Youth, never having had experience, cannot realize that hopeless debt is like a deep pit into which one may descend quickly and where one may struggle vainly for many days. It is a pit of sorrow and regrets where the brightness of the sun is overcast and night is made unhappy by restless sleeping. Yet I do not discourage borrowing gold. I encourage it. I recommend it if it be for a wise purpose. I myself made my first real success as a merchant with borrowed gold. Yet what should the lender do in such a case? The youth is in despair and accomplishes nothing. He is discouraged. He makes no effort to repay. My heart turns against depriving the father of his land and cattle.
"You tell me much that I am interested to hear," ventured Rodan. "But I hear no answer to my question. Should I lend my 50 pieces of gold to my sister's husband? They mean much to me."
"Thy sister is a sterling woman whom I do much esteem. Should her husband come to me and ask to borrow 50 pieces of gold, I should ask him for what purpose he would use it. If he answered that he desired to become a merchant like myself and deal in jewels and rich furnishings, I would say, what knowledge have you of the ways of trade? Do you know where you can buy at lowest cost? Do you know where you can sell at a fair price? Could he say yes to these questions?
No, he could not, Rodan admitted. He has helped me much in making spears, and he has helped some in the shops.
Then I would say to him that his purpose was not wise. Merchants must learn their trade. His ambition, though worthy, is not practical, and I would not lend him any gold. But supposing he could say, yes, I have helped merchants much. I know how to travel to Smyrna, and to buy at low cost the rugs the housewives weave. I also know many of the rich people of Babylon to whom I can sell these at a large profit. Then I would say, your purpose is wise and your ambition honorable. I shall be glad to lend you the 50 pieces of gold if you can give me security that they will be returned. But would he say, I have no security other than that I am an honored man and will pay you well for the loan? Then would I reply, I treasure much each piece of gold. Were the robbers to take it from you as you journeyed to Smyrna, or take the rugs from you as you returned, then you would have no means of repaying me, and my gold would be gone. Gold, you see, Rodan, is the merchandise of the lender of money. It is easy to lend. If it is lent unwisely, then it is difficult to get back. The wise lender wishes not the risk of the undertaking, but the guarantee of safe repayment. 'Tis well, he continued, to assist those that are in trouble. 'Tis well to help those upon whom fate has laid a heavy hand. 'Tis well to help those who are starting, that they may progress and become valuable citizens. But help must be given wisely, lest, like the farmer's ass, in our desire to help, we but take upon ourselves the burden that belongs to another. Again I wandered from thy question, Rodan, but hear my answer. Keep thy 50 pieces of gold. What thy labor earns for thee and what is given thee for reward is thine own, and no man can put an obligation upon thee to part with it unless it do be thy wish. If thou wouldst lend it so that it may earn thee more gold, then lend with caution and in many places. I like not idle gold, even less I like too much of risk. How many years hast thou labored as a spearmaker?
Fully 3.
How much besides the king's gift hast saved?
3 gold pieces.
Each year that thou hast labored, thou hast denied thyself good things to save from thine earnings 1 piece of gold?
'Tis as you say.
Then mightest save in 50 years of labor 50 pieces of gold by thy self-denial?
A lifetime of labor it would be.
Thinkest thou thy sister would wish to jeopardize the savings of 50 years of labor over the bronze melting pot, that her husband might experiment on being a merchant?
Not if I spoke in your words.
Then go to her and say, 3 years I have labored each day except fast days, from morning until night, and I have denied myself many things that my heart craved. For each year of labor and self-denial I have to show 1 piece of gold. Thou art my favored sister, and I wish that thy husband may engage in business in which he will prosper greatly. If he will submit to me a plan that seems wise and possible to my friend Mathon, then will I gladly lend to him my savings of an entire year, that he may have an opportunity to prove that he can succeed. Do that, I say, and if he has within him the soul to succeed, he can prove it. If he fails, he will not owe thee more than he can hope some day to repay. I am a gold lender because I own more gold than I can use in my own trade. I desire my surplus gold to labor for others and thereby earn more gold. I do not wish to take risk of losing my gold, for I have labored much and denied myself much to secure it. Therefore I will no longer lend any of it where I am not confident that it is safe and will be returned to me. Neither will I lend it where I am not convinced that its earnings will be promptly paid to me. I have told to thee, Rodan, a few of the secrets of my token chest. From them you may understand the weakness of men and their eagerness to borrow that which they have no certain means to repay. From this you can see how often their high hopes of the great earnings they could make, if they but had gold, are but false hopes they have not the ability or training to fulfill. Thou, Rodan, now have gold, which thou shouldst put to earning more gold for thee. Thou art about to become, even as I, a gold lender. If thou dost safely preserve thy treasure, it will produce liberal earnings for thee and be a rich source of pleasure and profit during all thy days. But if thou dost let it escape from thee, it will be a source of constant sorrow and regret as long as thy memory doth last. What desirest thou most of this gold in thy wallet?
To keep it safe.
Wisely spoken, replied Mathon approvingly. Thy first desire is for safety. Thinkest thou that in the custody of thy sister's husband it would be truly safe from possible loss?
I fear not, for he is not wise in guarding gold.
Then be not swayed by foolish sentiments of obligation to trust thy treasure to any person. If thou wouldst help thy family or thy friends, find other ways than risking the loss of thy treasure. Forget not that gold slippeth away in unexpected ways from those unskilled in guarding it. As well waste thy treasure in extravagance as let others lose it for thee. What next after safety dost desire of this treasure of thine?
That it earn more gold.
Again thou speakest with wisdom. It should be made to earn and grow larger. Gold wisely lent may even double itself with its earnings before a man like you groweth old. If you risk losing it, you risk losing all that it would earn as well. Therefore, be not swayed by the fantastic plans of impractical men who think they see ways to force thy gold to make earnings unusually large. Such plans are the creations of dreamers unskilled in the safe and dependable laws of trade. Be conservative in what thou expectest to earn, that thou mayest keep and enjoy thy treasure. To hire it out with a promise of usurious returns is to invite loss. Seek to associate thyself with men and enterprises whose success is established, that thy treasure may earn liberally under their skillful use and be guarded safely by their wisdom and experience. Thus mayest thou avoid the misfortunes that follow most of the sons of men to whom the gods see fit to entrust gold. When Rodan would thank him for his wise advice, he would not listen, saying, "The king's gift shall teach thee much wisdom. If wouldst keep thy 50 pieces of gold, thou must be discreet indeed. Many uses will tempt thee. Much advice will be spoken to thee. Numerous opportunities to make large profits will be offered thee. The stories from my token box should warn thee, before thou let any piece of gold leave thy pouch, to be sure that thou hast a safe way to pull it back again. Should my further advice appeal to thee, return again. It is gladly given. Ere thou goest, read this, which I have carved beneath the lid of my token box. It applies equally to the borrower and the lender. Better a little caution than a great regret." The Walls of Babylon. Old Banzar, grim warrior of another day, stood guard at the passageway leading to the top of the ancient walls of Babylon. Up above, valiant defenders were battling to hold the walls. Upon them depended the future existence of this great city with its hundreds of thousands of citizens. Over the walls came the roar of the attacking armies, the yelling of many men, the trampling of thousands of horses, the deafening boom of the battering rams pounding the bronzed gates. In the street beyond the gate lounged the spearmen, waiting to defend the entrance should the gates give way. They were but few for the task. The main armies of Babylon were with their king, far away in the east on the great expedition against the Elamites. No attack upon the city having been anticipated during their absence, the defending forces were small. Unexpectedly, from the north bore down the mighty armies of the Assyrians, and now the walls must hold or Babylon was doomed. About Banzar were great crowds of citizens, white-faced and terrified, eagerly seeking news of the battle. With hushed awe they viewed the stream of wounded and dead being carried or led out of the passageway. Here was the crucial point of attack. After 3 days of circling about the city, the enemy had suddenly thrown his great strength against this section and this gate. The defenders from the top of the wall fought off the climbing platforms and the scaling ladders of the attackers with arrows, burning oil, and, if any reached the top, spears.
Against the defenders, thousands of the enemy's archers poured a deadly barrage of arrows. Old Banzar had the vantage point for news. He was closest to the conflict and first to hear of each fresh repulse of the frenzied attackers. An elderly merchant crowded close to him, his palsied hands quivering.
Tell me, he pleaded. They cannot get in. My sons are with the good king. There is no one to protect my old wife. My goods, they will steal all. My food, they will leave nothing. We are old, too old to defend ourselves. Too old for slaves. We shall starve. We shall die. Tell me they cannot get in.
Calm thyself, good merchant, the guard responded. The walls of Babylon are strong. Go back to the bazaar and tell your wife that the walls will protect you and all of your possessions as safely as they protect the rich treasures of the king. Keep close to the walls lest the arrows flying over strike you. A woman with a babe in arms took the old man's place as he withdrew.
Sergeant, what news from the top? Tell me truly that I may reassure my poor husband. He lies with fever from his terrible wounds, yet insists upon his armor and his spear to protect me, who am with child. Terrible, he says, will be the vengeful lust of our enemies, should they break in.
Be thou of good heart, thou mother that is, and is again to be. The walls of Babylon will protect you and your babes. They are high and strong. Hear ye not the yells of our valiant defenders, as they empty the cauldrons of burning oil upon the ladder scalers?
Yes, that I do hear, and also the roar of the battering rams that do hammer at our gates.
Back to thy husband. Tell him the gates are strong and withstand the rams. Also that the scalers climb the walls but to receive the waiting spear thrust. Watch thy way and hasten behind you buildings.
Banzar stepped aside to clear the passage for heavily armed reinforcements. As, with clanking bronze shields and heavy tread, they tramped by, a small girl plucked at his girdle.
Tell me, please, soldier, are we safe? She pleaded. I hear the awful noises. I see the men all bleeding. I am so frightened. What will become of our family, of my mother, little brother, and the baby?
The grim old campaigner blinked his eyes and thrust forward his chin as he beheld the child.
Be not afraid, little one, he reassured her. The walls of Babylon will protect you and mother and little brother and the baby. It was for the safety of such as you that the good Queen Semiramis built them over 100 years ago. Never have they been broken through. Go back and tell your mother and little brother and the baby that the walls of Babylon will protect them and they need have no fear.
Day after day old Banzar stood at his post and watched the reinforcements file up the passageway, there to stay and fight until wounded or dead they came down once more. Around him, unceasingly crowded the throngs of frightened citizens eagerly seeking to learn if the walls would hold. To all he gave his answer with the fine dignity of an old soldier. The walls of Babylon will protect you. For 3 weeks and 5 days the attack waged with scarcely ceasing violence. Harder and grimmer set the jaw of Banzar as the passage behind, wet with the blood of the many wounded, was churned into mud by the never-ceasing streams of men passing up and staggering down. Each day the slaughtered attackers piled up in heaps before the wall. Each night they were carried back and buried by their comrades. Upon the 5th night of the 4th week, the clamor without diminished. The first streaks of daylight, illuminating the plains, disclosed great clouds of dust raised by the retreating armies. A mighty shout went up from the defenders. There was no mistaking its meaning. It was repeated by the waiting troops behind the walls. It was echoed by the citizens upon the streets. It swept over the city with the violence of a storm. People rushed from the houses. The streets were jammed with a throbbing mob. The pent-up fear of weeks found an outlet in the wild chorus of joy. From the top of the high tower of the Temple of Bel burst forth the flames of victory. Skyward floated the column of blue smoke to carry the message far and wide. The walls of Babylon had once again repulsed a mighty and vicious foe determined to loot her rich treasures and to ravish and enslave her citizens. Babylon endured century after century because it was fully protected. It could not afford to be otherwise.
The walls of Babylon were an outstanding example of man's need and desire for protection. This desire is inherent in the human race. It is just as strong today as it ever was, but we have developed broader and better plans to accomplish the same purpose. In this day, behind the impregnable walls of insurance, savings accounts, and dependable investments, we can guard ourselves against the unexpected tragedies that may enter any door and seat themselves before any fireside. We cannot afford to be without adequate protection. The Camel Trader of Babylon. The hungrier one becomes, the clearer one's mind works, also the more sensitive one becomes to the odors of food. Tarkad, the son of Azur, certainly thought so. For 2 whole days he had tasted no food except 2 small figs purloined from over the wall of a garden. Not another could he grab before the angry woman rushed forth and chased him down the street. Her shrill cries were still ringing in his ears as he walked through the marketplace. They helped him to restrain his restless fingers from snatching the tempting fruits from the baskets of the market women. Never before had he realized how much food was brought to the markets of Babylon and how good it smelled. Leaving the market, he walked across to the inn and paced back and forth in front of the eating house. Perhaps here he might meet someone he knew, someone from whom he could borrow a copper that would gain him a smile from the unfriendly keeper of the inn and, with it, a liberal helping. Without the copper, he knew all too well how unwelcome he would be. In his abstraction, he unexpectedly found himself face to face with the one man he wished most to avoid, the tall, bony figure of Dabasir, the camel trader. Of all the friends and others from whom he had borrowed small sums, Dabasir made him feel the most uncomfortable because of his failure to keep his promises to repay promptly. Dabasir's face lighted up at the sight of him. "Ha! 'Tis Tarkad, just the one I have been seeking, that he might repay the 2 pieces of copper which I lent him a moon ago. Also the piece of silver which I lent to him before that. We are well met. I can make good use of the coins this very day. What say, boy, what say?" Tarkad stuttered and his face flushed. He had naught in his empty stomach to nerve him to argue with the outspoken Dabasir. "I am sorry, very sorry," he mumbled weakly. "But this day I have neither the copper nor the silver with which I could repay." "Then get it," Dabasir insisted. "Surely thou canst get hold of a few coppers and a piece of silver to repay the generosity of an old friend of thy father who aided thee whence thou wast in need?" "'Tis because ill fortune does pursue me that I cannot pay." "Ill fortune! Wouldst blame the gods for thine own weakness? Ill fortune pursues every man who thinks more of borrowing than of repaying. Come with me, boy, while I eat. I am hungry, and I would tell thee a tale." Tarkad flinched from the brutal frankness of Dabasir, but here at least was an invitation to enter the coveted doorway of the eating house. Dabasir pushed him to a far corner of the room where they seated themselves upon small rugs. When Kauskor, the proprietor, appeared smiling, Dabasir addressed him with his usual freedom. "Fat lizard of the desert, bring me a leg of the goat, brown with much juice, and bread and all of the vegetables, for I am hungry and want much food. Do not forget my friend here. Bring to him a jug of water. Have it cooled, for the day is hot." Tarkad's heart sank. Must he sit here and drink water while he watched this man devour an entire goat leg? He said nothing. He thought of nothing he could say. Dabasir, however, knew no such thing as silence. Smiling and waving his hand good-naturedly to the other customers, all of whom knew him, he continued. "I did hear from a traveler just returned from Urfa of a certain rich man who has a piece of stone cut so thin that one can look through it. He put it in the window of his house to keep out the rains. It is yellow, so this traveler does relate, and he was permitted to look through it. And all the outside world looked strange and not like it really is. What say you to that, Tarkad? Thinkest all the world could look to a man a different color from what it is?" "I dare say," responded the youth, much more interested in the fat leg of goat placed before Dabasir. "Well, I know it to be true,
for I myself have seen the world all of a different color from what it really is, and the tale I am about to tell relates how I came to see it in its right color once more.
"Dabasir will tell a tale," whispered a neighboring diner to his neighbor, and dragged his rug close.
Other diners brought their food and crowded in a semicircle. They crunched noisily in the ears of Tarkad and brushed him with their meaty bones. He alone was without food. Dabasir did not offer to share with him nor even motion him to a small corner of the hard bread that was broken off and had fallen from the platter to the floor. "The tale that I am about to tell," began Dabasir, pausing to bite a goodly chunk from the goat leg, "relates to my early life and how I came to be a camel trader. Didst anyone know that I once was a slave in Syria?" A murmur of surprise ran through the audience, to which Dabasir listened with satisfaction. "When I was a young man," continued Dabasir, after another vicious onslaught on the goat leg, "I learned the trade of my father, the making of saddles. I worked with him in his shop and took to myself a wife. Being young and not greatly skilled, I could earn but little, just enough to support my excellent wife in a modest way. I craved good things which I could not afford. Soon I found that the shopkeepers would trust me to pay later, even though I could not pay at the time. Being young and without experience, I did not know that he who spends more than he earns is sowing the winds of needless self-indulgence, from which he is sure to reap the whirlwinds of trouble and humiliation. So I indulged my whims for fine raiment and bought luxuries for my good wife and our home, beyond our means. I paid as I could, and for a while all went well. But in time I discovered I could not use my earnings both to live upon and to pay my debts. Creditors began to pursue me to pay for my extravagant purchases, and my life became miserable. I borrowed from my friends, but could not repay them either. Things went from bad to worse. My wife returned to her father, and I decided to leave Babylon and seek another city where a young man might have better chances. For 2 years I had a restless and unsuccessful life working for caravan traders. From this I fell in with a set of likable robbers who scoured the desert for unarmed caravans. Such deeds were unworthy of the son of my father, but I was seeing the world through a colored stone, and did not realize to what degradation I had fallen. We met with success on our first trip, captured a rich haul of gold and silks and valuable merchandise. This loot we took to Guinear and squandered. The second time we were not so fortunate. Just after we had made our capture, we were attacked by the spearsmen of a native chief to whom the caravans paid for protection. Our two leaders were killed, and the rest of us were taken to Damascus, where we were stripped of our clothing and sold as slaves. I was purchased for 2 pieces of silver by a Syrian desert chief. With my hair shorn and but a loincloth to wear, I was not so different from the other slaves. Being a reckless youth, I thought it merely an adventure until my master took me before his 4 wives and told them they could have me for a eunuch. Then indeed did I realize the hopelessness of my situation. These men of the desert were fierce and warlike. I was subject to their will without weapons or means of escape. Fearful I stood as those 4 women looked me over. I wondered if I could expect pity from them. Sira, the first wife, was older than the others. Her face was impassive as she looked upon me. I turned from her with little consolation. The next was a contemptuous beauty who gazed at me as indifferently as if I had been a worm of the earth. The 2 younger ones tittered as though it were all an exciting joke. It seemed an age that I stood waiting sentence. Each woman appeared willing for the others to decide. Finally, Sira spoke up in a cold voice. "Of eunuchs we have plenty, but of camel-tenders we have few, and they are a worthless lot. Even this day I would visit my mother who is sick with the fever, and there is no slave I would trust to lead my camel. Ask this slave if he can lead a camel." My master thereupon questioned me, "What know you of camels?" Striving to conceal my eagerness, I replied, "I can make them kneel, I can load them, I can lead them on long trips without tiring. If need be, I can repair their trappings." "The slave speaks forward enough," observed my master. If thou so desire, sirrah, take this man for thy camel tender. So I was turned over to sirrah, and that day I led her camel upon a long journey to her sick mother. I took the occasion to thank her for her intercession, and also to tell her that I was not a slave by birth, but the son of a free